The title of today's sermon is Song of Solomon. Let's turn to the Song of Solomon. I'd like to begin in chapter 3. Please keep your marker in the Song of Solomon. We'll be going there all day. The name Song of Solomon is taken from the very first verse in the book. And if we could read and understood the Hebrew, it shows that what it literally means, and that is the song out of all the songs of Solomon, meaning it's this particular book that we have is especially singled out from all of Solomon's many songs. The Septuagint and the Latin Vulgate versions simply call this book the Song. The Song of Solomon is about the intimate happiness and joy within the marriage relationship that points to the unity and the oneness of Jesus Christ in us, the church brethren. Unlike the rest of the Bible, the Song of Solomon is poetic. It's the poetic dialogue of an opera-like drama, and it's composed of three players. It's a story of love. It's a story of romance. As an instruction manual with regard to the intimacy of the relationship between Jesus Christ and the bride, the church, brethren, this book is very informative. It's about a young woman, a shepherdess, called the Shulamite. She's fallen in love with a young man whom she calls my beloved. And like a Broadway production, everybody knows the plot and they know the ending. And yet, the fabulous production is a glory to behold as it's performed. That's the way this book is written. Somehow the music and the poetry causes the soul and the spirit to soar to great heights. Each generation has its own love of music. It's music of love, like when Elvis Presley sang, "Love me tender, love me true." There are times when music touches us and we don't forget when we heard it or where we were. It really changes us. The main story in the Song of Solomon concerns the stunning courtship of a beautiful Shulamite girl and a young, beloved shepherd. Their beautiful courtship is interrupted by Solomon, however. Solomon, on his travels up near Lebanon, he hears of this Shulamite's incredible beauty, so he looks her up. The story actually begins with Solomon roaring into an obscure, sleepy village, wearing his crown. He's in his chariot of gold and silver and upholstered with purple silk. Solomon's chariot that he's traveling in would be the stretch limousine of today. He's a veritable one-man parade as he arrives. And we read in the Song of Solomon, chapter 3 and verse 6, "Who is this that comes roaring out of the wilderness like pillars of smoke, perfumed with myrrh and frankincense, with all powders of the merchant?" Brethren, can you imagine how Solomon was all decked out? Verse 7, "Behold, it is Solomon, with 60 valiant men in his entourage, the valiant of Israel." So we see that Solomon traveled with a well-armed security detail, we'd call it. We see in verse 8, they all had swords, being experts in war. And then as you read down through verses 9 and 10, it describes the chariot, what it was made out of and what it looked like. And we go on down to verse 11, we see that the women swoon whenever Solomon comes near. But in verse 10, it talks about his chariot being paved with love. A strange translation, but it means that Solomon's chariot was designed especially for picking up women. That's what it means. For example, picture Donald Trump blowing into town and sweeping Melania off her feet with all his money, power, pomp, and circumstance. And little matter that there are already multiple wives in his life. An exact picture of Solomon at that time. That's the way that Solomon was. He was showering the Shulamite woman with mink and ermine furs, jewelry and fabulous clothes, champagne, caviar, flowers, the whole mix, the finest of everything. except for the one thing he could not offer her. He could not offer her unique love. If she were to succumb to Solomon's advances, she would have to share his love with 1,000 other women. Can you imagine what that would be like? There would be no exclusive relationship with Solomon, like with her beloved shepherd. She would never experience perfect oneness in unity. It seems if you are rich enough, you can have almost any woman that you want. And I emphasize almost any woman. And that was Solomon's modus operandi. He was trying to drive a wedge between the Shulamite and her beloved shepherd. As you may have deduced by now, Solomon is a type of the world with all of its temptations, trying to draw us away from Christ. Solomon woos her with the best lines. We see that in Song of Solomon chapter 4, verse 1. These best lines, he's had lots of practice in getting it just right. Here's an example. Behold, you're fair, my love. Behold, you are fair. You have the eyes of a dove within the curly locks of your hair. Drop down to verse 8. He's trying to seduce her. Come with me from Lebanon, my spouse. That's Solomon's off-the-cuff marriage proposal. Come with me from Lebanon. Look from the top of my Trump Tower, he might as well be saying. He compellingly coerced her to come to Jerusalem, pressuring her to be a part of his harem, and all against her better judgment. She refuses, but she's taken captive against her will and is taken to Solomon's court. What happened is Solomon pulled in there with so much hustle and bustle. He gave her the bum's rush, not giving her a chance to refuse him, and having her escorted to a confining coach for her protection, he would say. All the while, the Shulamite young lady's heart is with her beloved young shepherd. Their beautiful courtship was interrupted by Solomon, who abducted the beautiful Shulamite and desires to add the beautiful young lady to his bevy of beauties back in Jerusalem. In chapter 7, we see that Solomon only sees her as an object of sensuality. He would like to see her dancing and pleasing his senses. Let's go to chapter 1 of the Song of Solomon. What we see here is that the young Shulamite girl has her love and loyalty being tested. But what is this? We're talking spiritually today, brethren, on this Sabbath. This is a picture of the church's love and loyalty towards the true shepherd, Jesus Christ. In this young girl, she successfully resists Solomon's every indecent proposition and untoward advances toward her. So here in chapter 1, while she is being held against her will, the story begins with a flashback. It's a lot like if you were watching television or an opera today. We flash back to the time in the past. In scene 1, the beautiful young Shulamite woman is being detained in Solomon's court in the hopes that she'll consent to being one of the many women in Solomon's court, in Solomon's harem. The Shulamite pictures what it would be like to be back home, however, in the young shepherd's arm, receiving his attention instead, and his kisses. Chapter 1 and verse 2. Oh, for a kiss from your lips, she imagines. She's head over heels in love. Now, always keep your marker here in the Song of Solomon, but turn over with me to Proverbs chapter 9. The language of the Bible is poetic, and at the same time, it can be very pointed. For example, we won't find the Bible saying, don't sleep around to have fun. It says it in a much more poignant way. Proverbs 9 and verse 17. Stolen waters are sweet, and bread eaten in secret is pleasant. And brethren, to violate this rule is to permanently scar the being, robbing one of God's gift of a pure and innocent heart with the peace of mind and emotional maturity that goes with it. The young people in this drama were raised with godly principles and virtues to which they adhered with faithfulness. The world doesn't understand this book. You'll find all kinds of scenarios laid out about what's going on. A lot of people read this and think, oh, Solomon is married to this young girl, and they get it all mixed up. I want to lay it out, brethren, so we can see what's going on and how God's word is in here and what we're to learn from this. Both the young lady and the young men were raised on farms, and they were well-versed in animal husbandry. Neither one of them was naive about breeding sheep, cattle, and poultry. It was a day-to-day fact of life. The terms and nomenclature of procreation were by no means taboo, because such things were a part and parcel of everyday rural life. And there was no social or religious custom prohibiting or forbidding this acceptable discussion and dialogue among everybody. Little children grew up seeing the animals reproducing out there in the farm. And let's understand this. God intends that young men be attracted to shapely young ladies. And he wants young ladies to appreciate the strength and muscles of young men. That's what this book is talking about. God built into mankind a natural proclivity to come together and be one flesh. And John tells us in John chapter 17, don't turn there, brethren, John 17:21, that this is a type of oneness of Jesus Christ in his church. That's what we see in marriage. In the Song of Solomon, when the young lady and the young man speak about the pleasures of married life, they are not speaking from experience. A lot of people read this and go, oh my goodness, look what they're into. That's wrong. They're not speaking from experience, as many in this hardened world would believe. They're speaking in anticipation of the pleasures of man and wife, as God intended from the very beginning. This story follows the Shulamite woman from the time she's a little girl until her maturity as a marriageable young lady. As she rapidly approaches puberty, she, as well as her brothers, protect her chastity. We read in chapter 8 and verse 9, if she be a wall, we'll build upon her a palace of silver. That means if she stands for her virtue and morality, she's a wall. But if she's a door, we'll enclose her with boards of cedar. Well, not jumping ahead at all, brethren. She grew up to be a wall. You can put in your notes chapter 4 and verse 12. We'll see that. And she fell in love and longed for the day of her marriage. God uses virtuous young people as role models who represent the church. They're not people of the world that we're talking about here. They are virtuous. It's the virtuous church that will be the bride of Jesus Christ. As you read the Song of Solomon, read it in context. The King James Version does not note the changes in speakers. You can't see it as you read King James. You don't know who's speaking at any particular time. It makes the story a little difficult to follow. It's a short book. A little studying will reveal who's speaking in the different sections. If you see somebody speaking and he says, she is my love, then it's not her speaking. And you do a little research like that, and you can mark up your Bibles as to who's speaking at different times. It's just like in an opera. At different moments, different characters will be center stage, reciting their various dialogues. Sometimes it's the beautiful young Shulamite woman. Sometimes it's the beloved shepherd man. And sometimes it's Solomon that's speaking. Solomon is the villain, and the Shulamite woman is the heroine. Perhaps when the prose and the lyrical poetry were being sung, the shepherd's part may have been sung by a tenor, and the Shulamite girl's part maybe it was an octave higher, that of a soprano. And the other characters were represented by a chorus of singers. We don't know how it was presented, but you can be sure that it was very well known. Paul knew about it. John knew about it. Christ refers to it. It was a very, very popular play or operatic production all through the Old Testament and well into the New Testament. During the story, the young woman bears her emotions in the play much more than anybody else. Even the shepherd boy, he's not letting all of his emotions show like the young lady does. She articulates her emotions, her yearnings and anxieties, her fears and hopes, her delightful expectations in colorful similes and metaphors. She speaks of flowers and fragrant perfumes, fruit and animals, exotic spices, gold and ivory, in very expressive ways. In doing so, she presents a picture of how the church brethren are to view Christ in his spiritual characteristics and gifts. We even call them fruits of the Spirit. Jesus Christ has them perfectly. We are to put them on. We'll find ample opportunity to do so as we read through this book. Now, the unspoken theme throughout the entire story is, who will the Shulamite choose? And brethren, by extension, we should ask ourselves, who do we choose? Do we choose Christ or do we choose the world? Will she choose King Solomon, who offers her everything by way of untold riches, jewels, and servants, as a member of his multitudinous harem? Or will she refuse the pleasures of sin for a season, choosing instead the unique and profound everlasting love of the shepherd? The most beautiful of all the young virgins, of all the provinces of Israel, even foreign nations, were chosen by Solomon to be his wives and concubines. And there was a vetting process that they all had to go through. We're told in chapter 6 and verse 8 that there were virgins without number. They were brought in by the hordes, and they were vetted. They were set aside for a period of time. You can read about that in Esther chapter 2. Verses 12 and 13, how they had to go through their days of purification and so forth. Little does Solomon realize, or care for that matter, that the Shulamite has her heart set on a shepherd boy back home. The beautiful young Shulamite woman, she's also a shepherdess tending her flocks, in addition to her duties in the vineyard. As you read down through chapter 1, verses 6 and 8, you can see that she was a keeper of the vineyards, but it also shows that she had to pasture her sheep as well. In the Old Testament, the Jews read the Song of Solomon during Passover, the Passover season and the days of unleavened bread. There are many pictures of Jesus Christ in his relationship with the church brethren in this story. There's a great deal of symbolism in the Song of Solomon. The most important lesson for us, brethren, is the picture of marriage as a metaphor of the unbreakable covenant between Jesus Christ and the church brethren. When taken literally at face value, the Song of Solomon seems to be about physical romance and no more. But brethren, read between the lines. Understand why God has selected this song to put in his scriptures forevermore. Now please understand that some of the language in the Song of Solomon is very strong. It's graphic, even in the King James translation. To our Western ear, it sounds risque and all too explicit. There's some verses that you're just going to have to read on your own, brethren. I'm not going to read them out loud. The James Moffat translation is a little easier to understand because the syntax and verb tenses are quite different from ours. However, understand this, God is the author of the Song of Solomon. He's not ashamed of the human body and its reproductive capability. He created it that way. God created the process. He describes his handiwork as being very good in Genesis 1 and verse 31. Let me have you turn over to Genesis chapter 2, brethren. When God created Adam, He stepped back for a second. He looked at Adam and he said, I can do better than that. I give you that as an example, brethren. The Song of Solomon is filled with that type of innuendo. Adam and Eve had no clothes to begin with, and they thought nothing of it. They were all alone. It was entirely natural. Their nakedness only became unnatural when sin entered the scene. Genesis 2, in verse 25, we read, they were both naked, Adam and his wife Eve, and they were not ashamed. God says that was very good. Now here's what is not good. Genesis 2 and verse 18. And the Lord said, it is not good that the man should be alone. I will make him a helpmeet for him. So see, God is the author of this oneness, this unity, this togetherness. It's not good to be alone. And in the Song of Solomon, it's laid out in all its radiant splendor. When you read verses like this, it's not good that man should be alone. Don't think only of man and woman. Please, always extend your thinking to the greater fulfillment of God's plan. I'm speaking of Jesus Christ and the church brethren. Jesus fully intends that you and I be helpmeets to him. Let's plug it in, brethren. Let's understand what's being said. The Song of Solomon goes to great lengths to depict parts of the male or female physique and anatomy in metaphors drawn from nature. And sometimes they can be very delicate. Let's not be offended by that. God allowed it in his word. What we need to keep in mind is that the ultimate goal of the reproduction process is not only for human reproduction, human offspring, but for godly offspring. That's the end. That's the goal. More and more children of God. When viewed on a spiritual level, the Song of Solomon presents the intense and intimate personal relationship that Jesus has with his future bride. The very deeply passionate, inviolate covenant bond that only the wife, the church brethren, enjoy with him. Now we're told in 1 Kings, let's not go there, 1 Kings 11, Solomon loved many strange women. And then God said, you know, when you get old, they're going to turn your heart away after their gods. And Solomon foolishly did so. We're told in 1 Kings 11, 3, that Solomon had 700 wives, princesses of royal birth, and 300 concubines. And then we know that his wives turned away his heart. Thinking back, Solomon's father was King David. And King David had a way with music and poetry. He was a man of music. Often the Psalms were accompanied with music, and that greatly facilitated the memory of them. When words are set to music, they just stay with us. We tend to remember the exact words to a song. And so it serves its purpose. And so probably Solomon inherited this trait, and he wrote many songs, seemingly one for every wife. That's a lot of songs. We're told in 1 Kings 4 and verse 32 that Solomon wrote 1,005 songs. That's a lot of songs that he wrote, 1,005. We just saw that he had 700 wives and 300 concubines. So that's about, looks like he had the habit of writing a song for each one of these women that he married. And that's a lot. He wrote them and he published them and he sang them. Maybe he sang those on the night that they got together. Here's the interesting thing, brethren. God chose to preserve in his sacred writings only one of the songs. It was the very best song, and it became a part of the Word of God. All the rest have been discarded over time, or maybe Solomon himself discarded them. Let's go back to the Song of Solomon, chapter 6. Solomon pursued and tried hard to gain the love of this fair maiden, the Shulamite girl. But he was unsuccessful in wooing her. the young shepherd speaks in Song of Solomon 6 and verse 8. Solomon has 60 queens and 80 concubines and virgins without number. Verse 9, my dove, my undefiled. I want you to notice that, my undefiled. The Shulamite young woman is a virgin. My dove, my undefiled, is but one. He's comparing it to the many, many wives of Solomon. She's the only one of her mother, and she's the choice one of the one that bore her. So since we know that Solomon had 700 wives, 300 concubines, it seems to me that Solomon would not have written the Song of Solomon about himself as being a crass, vulgar, debaucherous, lustful, seductive man, as he appears in this book. I think, but rather realizing his mistakes, Solomon is self-deprecating. He's divulging his immoral behavior. It's like a confession. He's writing it down for all to see. Let me ask you this question to mull over, brethren. You don't need to answer it. Maybe there is no answer. Could Solomon have repented late in life after realizing the worthlessness of life apart from God and his ways, and then wrote the Song of Solomon, discarding all the rest of his songs? It seems to me that may have happened that way. God left room for Solomon to repent. God said, this is back in 1 Chronicles 28, verse 7, moreover, I will establish his, speaking of Solomon, I will establish his kingdom forever if he be constant or strong to do my commandments and my judgments as at this day. Let's go over to Ecclesiastes 9. And if you have two markers, I'd like you to put one in Ecclesiastes. I'm going to quote Ecclesiastes just a few times. I think the way it works is because Solomon has such a bad track record with all of those women, foreign women, who prayed to false gods. Because of his bad track record, God did not allow Solomon, because of his sins, to be a role model for his church. So we don't see deathbed conversions. God's not into deathbed conversions. Oh yeah, imagine they work, but boy, you sure don't depend on them, because God can withdraw his Holy Spirit and then you're a goner. I want you to know Solomon wrote late in his life, here in Ecclesiastes 9 and verse 9, live joyfully with the wife whom you love all the days of your life, which God has given you under the sun, for that's your portion in this life. Now, how would Solomon know that, looking back at his life, unless he repented? And God has concluded only this one single song, the Song of Solomon, out of 1,005 songs, because of its spiritual value in picturing Christ in the church. You can look over at Ecclesiastes chapter 3. That's where we read, to everything there's a season, a time to every purpose under heaven, and so forth. But when we come down to verse 5, Solomon says, there's a time to embrace and a time to refrain from embracing. When did he learn not to embrace all this multitude of women? We live in a disastrous world, even today. The world's out to rob young people of their full potential happiness. In today's putrid world, sexual thoughts and feelings are aroused in very young children. It ought not to be that way. Young people hear and have the pressure to use it or lose it. And it wars against the sanctity of marriage. This common circumstance is entirely detrimental to all youth's maturation process. Those who imbibe of sexual freedom are never able to attain to the full maturity of the deep, abiding, and giving love that God has in store for the mind, the spirit, and entirety of being. Song of Solomon chapter 2. Too many young people are robbed of their youth and their future. Children should be able to enjoy the fleeting carefree days of youth. We're told in the Song of Solomon chapter 2 and verse 7, I charge you, O your daughters of Jerusalem, by the roses and by the deer of the field, that you stir not up love, nor awaken love, before it is time to do so. Youth is a time for learning, fun, and excitement. We read in Song of Solomon chapter 8, verse 4, I charge you, O daughters of Jerusalem, that you stir not up love, nor awaken love, before it is time. Young people should enjoy their youth until they are emotionally mature. They shouldn't be meddling in things that will destroy their youth. They have to wait until they are emotionally mature and prepared to seek their marriage partner. Back in Ecclesiastes chapter 11, in verse 9, we're told, O young man, rejoice in your youth. Let your heart cheer you in the days of your youth. Walk in the ways of your heart and in the sight of your eyes. But know this, for all these things, God will bring you into judgment. So even though you're young and foolish, you can still get in a lot of trouble. But God's intention for each of us is joy and peace. We see that here. We urge our young people, do not enter into a relationship with anyone who's not prepared and determined to remain chaste and virtuous and pure prior to marriage. The shepherd girl is saying some of these things to herself in the play. It's a soliloquy. It's almost a prayer as she utters these things. A soliloquy is when you're talking to yourself like in a mirror or saying a prayer, so it's private. She is saying, in effect, I am saving myself and my fellow. He's saving himself as well. We're not like the world that yields to the flesh. We are preparing for our wedding day. Chapter 2 and verse 1. She says, I am the rose of Sharon and the lily of the valleys. So this young Shulamite is a type of the true church brethren. Now, she encounters these people that she calls the daughters of Jerusalem. They're almost like temple prostitutes. They're unconverted and worldly women who are not suitable brides. And I want you to notice how she, the Shulamite, is set apart. She says in verse 2, speaking of herself, as the lily among thorns, so is my love among the daughters. So this young Shulamite woman, she's a beautiful water lily blossom compared to the daughters of Jerusalem who are thorns. But could you imagine when she got to big downtown Jerusalem, can you imagine the pressure cooker environment that she was thrust into at Jerusalem with all those women vying for Solomon's attention and affection? Those women like the Moabites, Ammonites, Edomites, Zidonians, Hittites, and 1,000 more. Can you imagine what it would have been like that? The backbiting and more. The way that this young lady is explaining that she is a lily among the thorns. It's the same way for the virtuous men as well. You remember how when we went through the study of Joseph and Jacob, Joseph had to bring an evil report to Jacob about what his brothers were doing? Now, that's because it's not only the daughters of Jerusalem who are impure and immodest. Men are the same way. The young shepherd also found himself standing alone with those who should have been his peers. Picture this for a second. On one hand, you have a well-maintained apple orchard. All the apple trees all lined up, blossoming. The ground is clear. Everything is pruned. Everything is sculptured so beautifully. And on the other hand, you have a dense forest with undergrowth and brambles. That's what's about to be described. The young Shulamite girl draws the analogy in verse 3. As a lone apple tree among the trees of the forest, so is my beloved among the sons. So see, he's out there standing alone. And then the second part of this verse, brethren, and here's one of those beautiful pictures, as Paul said. I speak concerning Christ in the church. Continuing in verse 3. I sat down under his shadow with great delight, and his fruit was sweet to my taste. The young lady pictures the day that she will be wed. Verse 4. He brought me to the banqueting house, and his banner over me was love. This banner over me, that's a reference to their wedding canopy at their wedding banquet and ceremony. It's their gateway and portal to love. God intends that a man and his wife are virgins to each other when they make their covenant vow. That's the way it must be. That's the way God designed it. That's the way it is. Virgins to one another. Jesus mirrors these words in Revelation. This also speaks of the future bride, the church. Revelation 19, verses 7 and 8. She has made herself ready, and to her was granted that she should be arrayed in fine linen, clean and white, for the fine linen is the righteousness of the saints. You see the parallel between the Song of Solomon and what Jesus Christ says in Revelation? Here in the Song of Solomon, in chapter 6 and verse 2, my beloved has gone down into his garden, to the beds of spices, to feed in the gardens, and to gather lilies. Brethren, we can see here that these two young people have saved their charms and their love only for each other. Song of Solomon, chapter 6 and verse 3. I am my beloved's, and my beloved is mine. Not mixed with a thousand other people. There's a unique oneness there that they share. I want you to notice Song of Solomon, chapter 7 and verse 13. At our gates, this is thinking of once they're married and together. At our gates are all manner of pleasant and choice fruits. That's speaking of all of their charms. New and old. I have saved them, my darling, for you, O my beloved. Brethren, it is so clear. I don't know why the world says, you know, that everything's going on in this book is impure and immodest and adulterous and all of that sort of thing. It's very clear. I have saved them, my darling, for you, O my beloved. They're saving themselves for marriage. The young shepherd is head over heels in love with her during their courtship. Simply holding hands makes their hearts all aflutter, and it doesn't change as they grow old. Holding hands brings a unity, a love that harkens back to the very beginning of their days of love. The young man says, you could just knock me over with your little finger. He says it like this in chapter 4 and verse 9. You have ravished my heart, my sister, my spouse. You have ravished my heart with only one of your eyes, with one chain off of your neck. You just knocked me over with your little fingers, what he's saying. Verse 10, how fair is thy love, my sister, my spouse? How much better is your love than wine and the smell of your ointments and all spices? There's nothing better. Verse 11, thy lips, O my spouse, drop as the honeycomb. Honey and milk are under your tongue, and the smell of your garments is like the smell of Lebanon. Everything about her just drives him wild. The way she looks, the way she smells, her nose, her ears, her neck. He just looks at her and he falls apart. Then, I want you to notice this, brethren. Please mark this. Speaking of the beauty of virginity and the delights of God, we read in verse 12, chapter 4 and verse 12. A garden enclosed is my sister, my spouse. A spring shut up. A fountain sealed. She's not running wild. She's not giving herself to every Tom, Dick, and Harry. She has saved herself. This is the beauty of virginity. A garden enclosed. A spring of water shut up. A fountain sealed until after their wedding. There are no stolen waters here, as we saw back in Proverbs 9 and verse 17, are there? Before marriage, each partner has a godly right to know fully and completely the character, the true character of the one with whom they are about to enter a lifelong covenant. If, perchance, there is a past where something was wrong, done wrong, terribly sinful, it must be divulged to the future partner. You can't say, that's just between me and God. Jesus made that clear when he said that fraudulently and deceptively entering marriage was grounds for annulment. Read all about that in Matthew 19 and verse 9. When two people marry, they must know the true character entirely of the one they are entering their lifelong covenant with. This evil world demands the participation of every young person in conduct that God reserves only for the marriage bed. This world teaches that virginity is something to get out of the way. In doing so, lives are forever diminished and relegated to something much less than the oneness and the unity achievable only by those who respect the sacred marriage covenant. I don't know if you've ever noticed this in nature, brethren, but turtle doves, swans, geese, bald eagles, and other animals mate for life. They don't ever switch around. They don't ever seek another partner. They mate for life. Even wolves. Why? Because there's an indelible bonding that takes place in the mind and spirit of living things, and especially in human beings. An indelible bonding takes place deep within the human psyche. I've studied this, brethren. I don't know if it's psychological, physical, chemical, spiritual, but a bonding takes place forevermore with the one you love. A bonding of closeness and oneness all through the New Testament even. There is speech about becoming one flesh. Paul even says, if you go to a harlot, you become one flesh. We don't do that. God forbids that. God built a barrier into mankind that must not be breached by infidelity, before or during marriage. That's the way God designed mankind, because oneness and unity are characteristics of God the Father, Jesus Christ, and the body of Christ, the church, brethren. You can put a few of these in your notes, brethren. John 17, 21. This verse speaks of being one. One in us, one in the Father, one in Christ, and us being one with them as well. Another. 1 Corinthians 12 and verse 13. By one Spirit, we're baptized into one body. All of us. Another one. Ephesians 4, verses 3 and 4. Endeavoring to keep the unity of the Spirit. There's one body, one spirit, one hope of your calling. Philippians 1:27. You stand fast in one spirit, one mind. It goes on and on, brethren. Toward the end of the Song of Solomon, the couple shares their singular admiration for each other's beauty. And they swear to each other their undying love and marriage covenant forever. We read in Song of Solomon chapter 8 and verse 6. Set me as a seal upon your heart. A seal is something that can't be broken. Set me as a seal upon your heart, as a bracelet on your wrist, as a signet ring on your finger. For love is strong as death. Even today we say, till death do us part. Our passion is stronger than death, and the flaming coals thereof are coals of fire with a most intense heat. God is the author of passion as well. In some circles, people would say, ooh, that's not good talk. That shouldn't be said in church. God is the author of passion. God made it. It's a good thing. It has to be used in a godly fashion. How much more so for a young lady and a young man in love to refrain until their marriage day? When that principle is violated, past memories, wrong feelings, and bad emotions plague the mind and the being forevermore. There's some things you don't forget. Young people who engage in this misbehavior with others when they're too young, before marriage, And then finally they meet the young lady or the young man they want to spend the rest of their life with. You know what happens? Wrong memories will forever be replayed in the minds at the most inappropriate times, coming between husband and wife, destroying the oneness that God intended. It disallows a pure oneness in marriage, coming between the two partners in marriage. The amazing thing, and this boggles the mind as well, is that when one's mate dies in the faith, God is seeing to it that a new, undefiled relationship is achievable. You can start over. I hope I never go there, but some have. God makes all things new. And that's because God's marriage law is adhered to without violation. There are physical lessons and spiritual lessons to be found in this book, the Song of Solomon. I find it interesting that as Solomon wrote this play, he didn't mention her name. Perhaps God didn't want to single out any person. You know, he does say Rose of Sharon, but that's a place and not a person. But this Shulamite, young, beautiful woman, her name is not in the book. I think it's a little bit like guys that I knew in college that reveled in their exploits. And then years later, they couldn't even remember the girl's name. It's almost like Solomon forgot her name. There were so many women, like a good old what's her name, when he wrote this play. This story is about the battle, the pulls between true love and the way of the world that devours. I want to show you some of the allegories that you can take. And brethren, this will take hours of studying on your part, but to look at them. In the Song of Solomon chapter 2 and verse 14, we read something that we say, what do we make of this? Verse 14, O my dove that art in the clefts of your rock, from the nook in the cliff, let me see your countenance. Let me see your form. Let me hear your voice. For sweet is your voice, and our countenance is beautiful. It reminded me of Moses desiring to see Jesus Christ. You can put this in your notes, Exodus 33 and verse 18. Moses said, I beseech you, show me your glory. Almost exactly what she says, show me your beauty. And he says to her, show me your beauty. I want to see you. I want to dream about you. In Exodus 33 and verse 22, Jesus said to Moses, it shall come to pass while my glory passes by, I will put thee in a cleft in the rock. So we see cleft of your rock in the Song of Solomon. We see cleft of the rock back here in Exodus. God wrote these things. He meant them to be together. We're to seek God just as ardently as this young man seeks his young lady. And we know from 1 Corinthians 10 and verse 4 that Jesus Christ was that rock. In Song of Solomon chapter 3, this young Shulamite girl, she shares her good dream with us. Even in her sleep, she yearns for her beloved. Chapter 3 and verse 1, by night on my bed I sought him, whom my soul loves. I sought him, but I found him not. You ever have one of those dreams? It's kind of a restless dream, but yet it's a good dream. Verse 4, it was but a little that I passed from him, but I found him whom my soul loves. I held him. I wouldn't let him go. As we go down through this book, brethren, and we don't have near about time to go through it, even though it doesn't take very long to read the book, in chapter 7 and verse 10, her mind turns to her true love. She says, I am my beloved's, and his desire is toward me. That's the way it should be. Our desire should be toward Christ, because Christ desires us as well. The integrity of the love between the beautiful young Shulamite woman and the young beloved shepherd is demonstrative of the love between the church brethren and Jesus Christ. We're told even in the New Testament to sing in psalms and hymns and spiritual songs. So it's right for this book to be set to music. Just like the Song of Solomon, is a combination of psalms and spiritual songs. I believe when Paul wrote Ephesians 5 and verse 19, that he had the Song of Solomon in mind, even when he wrote his epistle. Here's a synopsis of Ephesians chapter 5. He talks about that he might sanctify and cleanse the church by the washing of the water by the word, that he might present it to himself a glorious church. He talks about the relationship between a man and a woman. They don't hate their own flesh. My wife is my flesh. I'm her flesh. We're one flesh. We nourish it. We cherish it. Even as the Lord, the church, he says in Ephesians 5 and verse 29. He's drawing the same exact analogy that we see in the Song of Solomon. We're members of his body and of his flesh and of his bones. It speaks about the bond of unity between a man and his wife. Perfect unity is a picture of Christ in the church. And he even comes right out and says it in Ephesians 5 and verse 32. What we see in the Song of Solomon, what we've been talking about today, Paul says, it's a great mystery, but I speak concerning Christ in the church. Nevertheless, let every one of you in particular so love his wife, even as he loves himself. You know, we don't starve ourselves. We don't hurt ourselves. That's the way we love our wives. We give them everything that they need. And the wife, see that she reverences her husband. Let me give you just a few notes to put in your Bible, because we're talking about the beloved shepherd. And it is replicated over and over in the New Testament. Jesus Christ is the good shepherd. That's John chapter 10 and verse 11. Jesus Christ is the chief shepherd. That's 1 Peter 5 and verse 4. Jesus Christ is the great shepherd. Hebrews 13 and verse 20. The good shepherd gives his life for the sheep. The chief shepherd gives the crown of glory that doesn't fade away. The great shepherd ushers in the everlasting covenant, speaking about marriages. Now, I mentioned that certain sections in the Song of Solomon are dreams. The Song of Solomon opens with the Shulamite held captive in Solomon's court, desiring to be free and remembering the days that she first met her beloved shepherd boy. That's in chapter 1 and verse 4. She remembers when she first asked her beloved where he tended his sheep. That's in chapter 1 and verse 7. The marriage union of a man and his wife is the closest human parallel to Christ's relationship with us. The Song of Solomon is a parable drawn from everyday life, and it illustrates a godly principle. And brethren, it's not surprising that it contains prophetic overtones. There are two dream sequences in the Song of Solomon, and they parallel such things as the wise and the foolish virgins. You read Matthew chapter 25 about the wise and the foolish virgins. It talks about doors being closed, doors being open. In the first dream, that's in Song of Solomon chapter 3, the Shulamite seeks her beloved husband. She's tossing and turning all night. Her love for him is so consuming that she restlessly, she looks for him everywhere. She's not fulfilled yet. In the depth of her dream, she finds him and she desires to marry him. It says in Song of Solomon 3 and verse 4, I found him whom my soul loves. I held him and I wouldn't let him go until I had brought him into my mother's house for marriage and into the chamber of her that conceived me. And the scene changes entirely a little later as we get to chapter 5. There's another scenario being played out. In the second dream, the shepherd, again, he's still faithful in marriage, but she questions her continuing faithfulness. We see that he's faithful in verse 1. She wonders, will she always be strong and faithful? What if she should fall? What if she should slip? In the second dream, it's as though she's fretting. Verse 2, Song of Solomon 5 and verse 2. I sleep, but my heart awakens. It's the voice of my beloved that knocks, saying, open to me, my sister, my love, my dove. Open to me, my undefiled. My head is filled with dew, and the locks of my hair with the drops of night, the dew of night. So he's outside knocking, let me in, let me in. In her dream, she finally, reluctantly, lethargically, she rises, but because of her lack of zeal and her slowness to respond, to open the door. When she gets there and opens the door, it's too late. He's gone. She turns into a nightmare. Jesus tells us he's the door. He builds on this story from the Song of Solomon. He that enters in by the door is the shepherd. It fits perfectly, brethren. That's John 10 and verse 2. Verse 7, 1 John 10 and verse 7. I am the door of the sheep, Jesus said. In the parable, Matthew 25 and verse 10, while some of the virgins went away, the door was shut. So this is what she's dreaming. Is it possible to lose out on this relationship with Christ? You can read on down through Matthew chapter 25. It talks about the door opening and closing. But there's a warning there, brethren, even for us. It's prophetic. All the way back in the Song of Solomon, we're told in Revelation 3 and verse 20, the last book of the Bible, Revelation 3 and verse 20, behold, I stand at the door and knock. Again, a perfect parallel to what she dreamed. He's at the door knocking. Jesus says, I stand at the door and knock. If any man hears my voice and opens the door, I'll come into him. But she's fretting. You know, she's too slow. She's too lethargic to open the door. She finally rushes out to find him, and it's too late. There's another parallel in Matthew chapter 22. There's this wedding feast that's going on in Matthew chapter 22. You know the story. But in Matthew 22 and verse 12, the king said, friend, how came you in hither without a wedding garment? Well, what had happened in her dream, she dreamed that the watchmen beat her, they wounded her, and they took her veil. Her wedding veil was taken. Jesus asked the question rhetorically, how do you try to get in without a wedding garment? Bind him. Take him away, hand and foot, Jesus says. So, brethren, when you put this all together, the dream in Song of Solomon 5, it's a warning to us to remain faithful in the last days. The time for Christ to return is close. We cannot ignore the knock at the door. Even now, the scriptures tell us, Jesus says, I am at the door knocking. Open up to me. And we're warned back in Isaiah 55 and verse 6, seek the Lord while he may be found. Call upon him while he's near. Brethren, that's today. We need to stir up the passion. We need to stir up the zeal. We need to draw near. Do we feel our love for Christ? We know that Christ loved the church. He died for us. Do we love Christ the way this young Shulamite woman loved her beloved with every ounce of her being? We saw in the Song of Solomon, chapter 3 and verse 1, by night on my bed, I sought him whom my soul loves. I sought him. In verse 4, she says, I found him whom my soul loves. I held him. I would not let him go. Brethren, that's the story of the church. The Song of Solomon is the story of the triumph of faithful loyalty, the triumph of true love over the seduction of the world, of wealth and flattery, over power and privilege, of bondage. We can't be bound to this world. And we know through the New Testament, God in his mercy has made it possible for us to be spiritual virgins to Jesus Christ at his return. Yes, we've sinned. We've made our mistakes. Each Passover, we pour our heart out. We renew our vow. Oh God, make us clean. Create a new heart in me. Brethren, we await the day when we will hear him say, come to me, my beloved.